there are two series of these numbers, and they run from Molly to Dan and from Jerry to Dolores. And others that come late will be apportioned. This left-hand side, during the break, I want you to collect together down in the front part of the yard, and those on this right side to collect together in the back part of the yard with a pencil and some paper. I'll give you each a sheet of paper, and there'll be two groups with one sheet of paper. And each of you will have a pencil, or you can take just one pencil or one pen. And the first number in the sequence will write a haiku. And the following numbers in the sequence will write haikus linking up to the haiku before them. So that number one, in either case, if there is a number one or a number two or wherever the sequence begins, the earliest number, we'll do the initial haiku. And the following numbers in sequence, we'll do linked haiku with them. And then I'll be, during the break, Xeroxing your haiku into a second pamphlet. And the third pamphlet will be the two sheets which you bring in at the end of the break, and we'll copy those so that you'll have three different collections of haiku. You'll have the initial set. You'll have the set that you've been working on the second time around. And you'll have the third, rather formal sequence that links together as a whole. And this should be food for thought for you of these three collections. Food for thought, not just for writing haiku, but for the nature of poetry. Poetry is a mystery, and it's the first of all the arcane schools. Poetry comes first. Poetry is the root of religious initiation into mystery schools. And it's important for you to have an insight into this on your own. Now, in a classical first century AD work on literary criticism, the author for a long time was thought to be Longinus, and in fact the publication is still under the name Longinus, but technically should be referred to as pseudo-Longinus. We don't know who the author is, and it certainly isn't Longinus. Longinus lived in the 3rd century AD. This author is contemporaneous with Jesus, early 1st century AD, probably turn of the millennium. His treatise is called On the Sublime, and it is the finest statement in the Greek language in an antiquity of what poetry and what art are, and the workings of the human mind in achieving this, and the training of a person to be able to be an artist, to be artistic, not only in production but in appreciation, so that the cream of aesthetic theory in antiquity is in Longinus's On the Sublime. Now, he writes in here, and I want to give you just two little quotations. This is from the Penguin Classics edition. He's writing about Plato, talking in the Republic about artistic creativity, and then Longinus, or pseudo-Longinus, writes, "Provided that we are ready to give Plato due attention, this author shows us that, in addition to those already mentioned, there is another way that leads to the sublime. And what kind of a way is this? It is the imitation and emulation of the great historians and poets of the past. Let us steadfastly keep this aim in mind, my dear fellow, for many authors catch fire from the inspiration of others. Just as we are told that the Pythian priestess, which would have been the priestess at the Oracle of Apollo at Delphi, just as we are told that the Pythian priestess, when she approaches the tripod, standing by a cleft in the ground from which they say there is breathed out a divine vapor, is impregnated thence with the heavenly power, and by virtue of this afflatus is at once inspired to speak oracles. So too, as though also issuing from sacred orifices, certain emanations are conveyed from the genius of the men of old into the souls of those who emulate them, and breathing in these influences, even those who show very few signs of inspiration derive some degree of divine enthusiasm from the grandeur of their predecessors. Notice the mystical quality of inspiration here. And then he writes, further, dignity, grandeur, and powers of persuasion are to a very large degree derived from images, for that is what some people call the representation of mental pictures. In a general way, the term image is used of any mental conception from whatever source it presents itself, which gives rise to speech. The image gives rise to speech. But in current usage, the word eidolon, or image, is applied to passages in which, carried away by your feelings, you imagine you are actually seeing the subject of your description and enable your audience as well to see it. You will have noticed that imagery means one thing with orators and another with poets. That in poetry its aim is to work on the feelings, in oratory to produce vividness of description, though indeed in both cases an attempt is made to stir the feelings. And then he gives a quotation, in fact two quotations, from Euripides. The first from the Orestes. Mother, I beseech you, do not set upon me those blood-boltered and snake-like hags. See there, they approach, they leap upon me. And again, from Euripides' Iphigenia and Taurus. Ah, she will slay me, whither shall I fly? Longinus. In these passages, the poet himself had seen the Furies, and he almost compelled his audience, too, to see what he had imagined. Now, Euripides extends his highest powers in giving tragic expression to these two passions, madness and love. And he is more brilliantly successful with these, I think, than with any others, although he is not afraid to make incursions into other realms of imagination. And he goes on in this way and contrasts Euripides with Homer and with a different type of imagery. What's important here, and you can think on this along with my words, when you imagine a picture in your mind, for instance, if I am describing an object which is before you, you will correlate my words with the object. If I begin talking about this Chinese lamp and talk about the jade finial and the upward sweep of the shade and the impression in the woven part of the shade of the bamboo leaves, which are better seen when the light is on from behind them. The words convey you to the physical object. The words refer you to nature. This kind of language is mythical language. And for you to then close your eyes and listen to the same words, you attempt a mimetic activity of reconstructing this object as an image in your mind. That also is participating on a mythic level. The source of the picture is actually in the feeling tone. And the better that I convey in my words a feeling tone, saying, do you remember the lamp that used to be on my Chinese desk when you would come on Saturday mornings for the lectures, and on cloudy days the lamp would be lit, and so forth. I'm cueing you to be able to engender this image in a mythic way, unfolding it in. If I change the inflection of the language, if I ask you, how high is that lamp? How wide is the shade? How many colors are in the base? Not the design, but how many colors are in the base? If I ask you questions like that, if I use language like that, instead of imagination, your image is cued in from a mnemonic, a memory function. It's changed its inflection from a kind of imagined quality to a symbolic quality. And in order for you to remember, in order for that symbolic language to come into play, you have to position yourself back there into those events. Rather than focusing on the image in nature, you focus on you and your experience, because you can only work memory out of yourself. The memory doesn't work out of nature, but works out of yourself. So the source of memory is your deep self, the integration of your experience. The source of imagination is nature. There are two different modes, easy to confuse, easy to blur. The more that you are able to engender the presence of your deep self, the more memory is quite distinct to function from imagination. The more self-presence you have, the more you can catch yourself when it's operating that you are now remembering, you are now imagining. And in fact, you can come with experience to understand that imagination and memory are complementations. One could even say that in imagination you're dealing with a perceptual matrix, and in memory you're dealing with a conceptual matrix, dealing differently. What structures the memory is an ideational structure. Patterned around some central point of focus, and if one could resolve those central points of focus, they would all be montaged upon the deep self itself. Your deep self is really the center of all of your memories. It's a different process. Whereas in imagination, there is not this quality of self-presence. There's a quality of naturalness. So that, for instance, in Homer's language, in Homer's imagery, everything is externalized. Anything that is ever mentioned in Homer is immediately given externalization. The whole passage, the flow of the passage, is suspended, and whatever length of supposed digression necessary to externalize that image. For instance, one of the famous examples is in the Odyssey of Homer. Odysseus is in disguise, and he's come back after 20 years, and the house is besieged by 105 suitors, and his son doesn't know if he can trust the gods and can fight. His mother, Penelope, the wife of Odysseus, doesn't know whether she should marry again or not, or whether the time has finally come. And in all of this, Odysseus has come back, but he's in disguise. And he attends a banquet which the suitors are giving for themselves, because on the next day, Penelope will be forced to choose one of them. So this is their great, and part of the etiquette is to have your feet washed before the banquet. And even disguised as an old beggar, Odysseus must have his feet washed, and the old serving woman, Eurycleia, is washing his foot, and she feels with her hand the scar in a particular part of the foot, and she knows it's Odysseus. And Homer has Odysseus immediately sense that she knows who he is, and immediately both his hands come out, one hand around her mouth, the other hand around her neck. And very quietly he signs her with his eyes not to say anything. It's all in one movement, a hidden movement to anyone else, but she feels the full brunt. But Homer, in this dramatic moment, stops the narration of the story and goes into a digression of how this scar came, a hunting accident when he was a little boy, and how he was he came into his father with the blood coming out, and this nurse, Eurycleia, who was a young girl, was made to wash the wound, and so forth. Anytime an image turns up in Homer, it must be given its complete exfoliation. There is no implication whatsoever. Everything is explicit. So that the Homeric image base is the epitome, it's the perfection of the mythic language style. And that in Homer, because all images are given their full externalization, all of the feeling tones which are associated with those images are also given full expression. So that Homeric man, as it were, someone who is schooled from youth on Homer and that kind of an image base, has the feeling tonedness of cleanness in the sense of wide openness. The Homeric religious ceremony takes place in the open, not in the temple. For Homer, the home of the gods is on top of Mount Olympus, on top of the mountain, not on top of the Acropolis in a city, but out in nature in a prominence. Zeus is king of the gods in Homer, and the oracular place of Zeus, Olympia, home of the Olympics, is in a grove of oaks. So that the Homeric divinity is the epitome of the natural openness of man initiated and opened, the human person opened to the completeness of their feeling capacity. Every image capacity that you have has been externalized in the mythic language, and you have been opened up so that your completion is that you are opened to the full sphere of your feeling capacities and your image base. In Euripides, this very openness is now a jeopardy. Dionysus is the god of that openness towards Zeus without any kind of defining or limiting shape. It is the, quote, openness itself which Dionysus is the god of, the unlimited. the life, the Greek word for life, Zoe, here has got to be modified a little bit. We get zoological from the Greek term here. I think the French phrase that Henri Bergson used, Ilan Vatel, is more like Dionysus. It's the energeia of life, which in its working works through any kind of shapes or forms, including unshaped shapes and unformed forms. And so Dionysus is that. Where in Homer, Dionysus is not conspicuous at all. The life energy is free to work in the opening process. But for Euripides, the problem of boundaries, the problem of shapes, the problem of limits, the problem of forms within which this energy can be channeled is paramount. And in particular, the largest structure in which life energy is structured in Euripides' time is the social structure, the structure of the society as a whole. Larger even than the city, although the city, the polis, would have been the largest structure that the Greeks were able to control. That is, in terms of the field of the social structure of life energy, the Greeks could exert their control to the shape of a city. But they couldn't make the next jump to extend it to a league of cities and make it stick. The Delian League, the Athenian League, the Spartan League, none of these leagues ever worked, because they were simply extensions of the shape and the power and the comprehension of the city. So that eventually, in the classical world, they never were able, no persons, no communities were ever able to extend to the interpolis level of societal forms. Rome eventually became a transcendent super city, and the Roman Empire was, to all extents, the extension of the city of Rome in metaphorical ways, but it was still based on the city. Indeed, Augustine's City of God makes Christianity an extension of a city. But the problem is that even extending the city in this way does not solve the problem. It does not give a shape, a sociological shape, a political shape to life for man. And the problem comes up in Euripides' Bacchae. It's like the very center of the target of the problem. Euripides' Bacchae is the place where the Greek genius breaks, where the realization is that the life force, the life energeia, cannot be hemmed in and closed in by the shape of man's polis, by his city. Now, the polis, the city, is the culminating apex of the development of how families knit together, clans and tribes knit together and make the city, the very structure, the sociological functioning pattern, the fabric of the city, is the weaving together of the families and the clans and the tribes, that they can be woven together and make one city. Was always the great achievement. And this is why, for instance, Athens was always the great example. It was not only in the 5th century BC, not only one of the largest cities, not very large by our standards, including all of the slaves. Athens was never larger than Fresno. and the freed male population of Athens at its height in Pericles' time was never more than about 30,000 men. So you can understand it's a very small place in our terms, but in the 5th century BC, for a coherent human structure, it was one of the most conspicuous of all. It was very large, but it was also very, very powerful in that it worked according to rational ideas, rational conceptions of the extension of these forms. Dionysus and Dionysiac energy cannot be contained by such a city. The city cannot contain it. The city can express it occasionally, but cannot contain it indefinitely, or even for a long time, and especially cannot contain it forever. Now, the way in which the city was made to express but not contain the Dionysiac energy of life was that every spring, when the energies of life are flowing, late February, early March, at the latitude of Greece, 2,500 years ago, spring would have come around the end of February. At that time, the Dionysiac energy was expressed in productions of dramas in the theater of Dionysius in the city of Athens. And I brought out the World Standard volume on the theater of Dionysius in Athens, Pickard Cambridge's great volume, published here by Oxford. And you can see during the break, the frontispiece has a photograph of the ruins of the theater of Dionysius. It is in the theater of Dionysius in the spring, in the festival of Anastherion, that you have the Greek tragedy and also Greek comedy presented. It was the politan form by which this energy, could you shake here a little bit, by which this energy was expressed. In Euripides' Bacchae, which is the last great Greek tragedy, he looks back in retrospection and he says, we cannot do it anymore because we are conscious of what we are doing, and in that consciousness we realize that our conception is inadequate. It's inadequate. Now you need to know one thing about Greek tragedy. You had to go. It wasn't like theater today where you go if you feel like going. When the time came, you were forced to go and view the productions. There were special community police in Athens who had long white ropes, and they would start at the rims of the city, and they would go from house to house and roust you out and herd you along with the ropes. Everyone was forced to go because this was a part of the way in which it was the linchpin by which the wheel of the shape of the conception of the city worked. It is necessary for a wheel to work. And for a wheel to work, it has to spin. For the wheel of the city to spin, the population must be together. They must be sociologically and politically, but especially religiously together. They must be able to move together as an entity, as the city. And the gasoline for that motion was life, life energy. Now you can see how important this is when the realization came that we can't really do it anymore. The realization was that, literally, Athens as the apex of Greek culture didn't work anymore. Now, the The generation that realized that included in Euripides, not in Euripides, but the old Plato and the young Aristotle. Those kinds of individuals were around. And you find, for instance, in Plato, that the whole trust in the mythic pattern of expression falters. The last great dialogue of Plato, The Laws, doesn't resemble any of the other Platonic dialogues. It's like a huge tome. It's like a prose tome instead of a dialogue. The whole mythic structure of the dramatic interchange between people is no longer trusted. The Laws is really one person, the author, saying this is how it is, and giving up the, quote, pretense of dialogue, of dramatic interchange, to present meaning and ideas and conceptions. And in fact, in Aristotle, you don't see him trust the dialogue form at all. He writes treatises, much like we would recognize even today. So that the whole tone of mythic capacity, which had been intact from Homer down to Euripides, was lost in one generation. Now you can say, like Arnold Toynbee says in A Study of History, he uses a very English Empire phrase. He said it was a failure of nerve. But you have to appreciate the poignancy of this. It's the inability to adequately symbolize the image base which your own feeling capacity is able to throw up. Or to use a more Gentile term, to generate. In other words, your feelings generate more capacity than your inner self is able to integrate. And you realize that there is a discrepancy between the conceptions that you're capable of and the anxieties which you are capable of. And when the anxieties outstrip your ability to deal with them, you can call it anything at all, but you understand what the final development in that is, a loss of confidence in being able to implicitly understand, and the regression back to needing an explicit, natural assurance in order for you to deal with. One of the psychological bases of autism. The autistic person doesn't trust their ability to prorate activities. They have to have everything just so. And it's a key to this whole personality structure. So you can see that this is a universal problem. And you can see that the example of Euripides' Bacchae gives us a poignant way to focus on the idea of the failure of trusting ideas, the failure of the symbolic life, as Jung would talk. And largely a therapeia, then, is reconstituting this confidence in your ability to lead a symbolic life which is adequate to the feeling capacities that you are able to manifest. This is true for the individual. It is true for the sociological community. But notice that the extension of the sociological community is an inherent part of the structural problem, which is why you find increasingly, after this failure of nerve in Greece, you find increasingly populations of people separating themselves off from the general society and trying to perfect themselves in little ideal situations. You increasingly find that. For instance, Plato leaves Athens about the time that this would have been written. Plato would have left Athens to go to Syracuse to try and set up an ideal state under Dion. and as these things always happen, it never works out. They never do work out. There's a mythical reason why they don't work out. They never will work out. Part of the clue here is that you cannot refine an old form to be adequate. You have to generate a new form for the larger capacity. The problem is to understand you can never polish up an old form to make it work under new situations. You have to generate a new form. It's a primordial realization that consciousness must come to terms with. For instance, like in a person's life, you cannot educate the 20-year-old self that you had, your capacities at age 20, to deal with life in your 50s, to deal with the capacities that you have as a human being. And it doesn't matter how many health clubs you go to try and get a 20-year-old body, even if you did, it's not going to be adequate because your 20-year-old self cannot live in the extended capacities of somebody who is now in their 50s and knows an awful lot more about life. It's like a way of understanding that you have to generate a new integration, a new form, so that the old integration must undergo a death and a transfiguration and a rebirth, so that the process of initiation always follows this kind of a sequence, and that death involves, the Greek term for this was an agon. We get the English term agony from this. All these polite terms, anxiety and angst and so forth, are just so many euphemisms. Agony. The agony comes from the dissolution of the old self. But the key insight, which Greek tragedy brought in, was that this dissolution happens only on a mythic level. It happens only for a mythic image that one had of oneself, a projected mask of oneself, that your real deep self is of such a nature that it cannot come unraveled, does not come unraveled. Its capacities are never jeopardized. It is only the ritual mask, role, mythic image that must be dismembered in this agon, and a new capacity must be generated. Notice how the themes are all brought together by Euripides in the Bacchae. The same themes of the city, the themes of the person, the themes of the dismemberment, the themes of the working with complementation, the themes of the city and the individual, of the myth and the mystery. All of these themes are brought together in one single work. Now, I don't have time to go through the whole thing, but I want to give you a little bit here. In sociological terms, in the social, political realm, the agon, I'm reading here from this wonderful study by Helen Foley on Ritual Irony, Poetry and Sacrifice in Euripides. Her language here is very refined, and I'd like to use her language for a moment. The agon is designed to control competitive violence within a society and to promote its glory, collapses into intra-social violence and disaster for its participants. In other words, the agon does not come as a surprise. That stage has already been gone through. It's a archetypal phase in initiation. And in setting up any kind of a structure, one has already gone through a certain kind of a resolution for that. The point is that you're not facing this situation for the first time, but that you're facing it with a new dimensionality, and you have to have a new dimension. There's another dimension here. While in nature you might have four dimensions of length, breadth, depth, and time, when you add consciousness, it's like adding another dimension. It's like adding a fifth dimension. The whole, we even use the word, the epithet, in a semi-implicit way. The whole theater of ideas is enlarged. And you see how our language carries, even in metaphor, the realization of these archetypal events and the way that they have happened in our past. This is true in any kind of a society. For instance, the plays of Chikamatsu at the time of Basho in Japan are extremely accurate for presenting this. The plays of the dramatic theories of the great no dramatist Zayami are extremely poignant and reveal an in-depth understanding of this, of the dynamics of this whole operation. With consciousness, the deep self is cued in and comes into play. Nature becomes supernatural. That is to say, if you stayed in a natural dimension, what is happening now becomes supernatural, or as we would say today in the 20th century, because we use the term surreal more than supernatural, but it has a similar meaning. The surreality of consciousness must be brought into play. So that the Aegon, which was designed to control competitive violence within a society and to promote its glory, so that stage was woven into the type of initiation that would help people to join that form in that society, when it doesn't work anymore, it collapses. In fact, it collapses sociologically, but it implodes personally. The personal experience of it is almost instantaneous. One of the great examples of it happening, it's a psychological crisis. One of the great examples is in Bertrand Russell's autobiography, where he's riding a bicycle on the Cambridge University campus. And he suddenly realizes in a flash, and he says it, and he writes it out. He realizes in a flash he doesn't love his wife anymore. He can't live with her ever again. He can never think accurately enough to write a book like Principia Mathematica again. That he is just now, in this last instant, crossed a threshold, and he isn't even the same person anymore. And even though he lived 97 years, he was never again able to return back and be that exquisite Bertrand Russell, committed to that marriage, committed to writing those exquisite, accurate books on logical forms like Principia Mathematica. He becomes interested in social issues, which the younger Bertrand Russell couldn't have cared a fig for. He becomes interested finally in the problem of mankind facing this kind of situation, that nuclear war is exactly this terrific threshold for all human beings considered as a whole. And that it's like an initiation threshold for the planet. So that Helen Foley writing here, all of this initiatory sophistication, ritual mastery, mythic comprehension and integration, which has served to flesh out and hold a certain pattern of life together, when it breaks in an individual, it implodes, but in a society, it collapses. It takes about a generation for it to collapse. Sometimes in really larger extended forms, like the Roman Empire, it took about 2 centuries for it, or 10 generations for it to collapse. Collapses into intersocial violence, or if it is collapsing in a person, interpersonal. The different roles